From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is out this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. When the Mueller report was finished, with only the barest conclusions known, to us anyway, the talking heads retreated to their predictable corners to celebrate their victory.
This was a tremendous, tremendous victory for the president, a tremendous victory for the United States of America.
Or steel themselves to fight on.
We will demand the release of the full report. The American people are entitled to a full accounting of the president's misconduct referenced by the special counsel.
All of this was based on Attorney General William Barr's four-page summary of a report that was over 300 pages, maybe up to 1,000. Without a presidential perp walk, and that was never in the cards, Fox News leapt at the opportunity to call for the mainstream media's heads.
911, I'd like to report a death. It's the mainstream media finally choking on their own lies. Now, this should be a victory lap, but it won't undo the harmful crap the country went through thanks to a media who pushed this hallucination.
Fox News's visceral Greg Gutfield. But he is in the vicinity of a point about what many have seen as a mainstream media problem. Responsible outlets in reporting the news may well have focused too much on the president's claim that there was no collusion between his campaign and the Kremlin that he obsessed about, tweeted about over 100 times.
For 2 years, we've been saying, you know, did he commit the crime of collusion? And the answer is there's no such crime,
says Slate's Dahlia Lithwick. More worrying, she says, is the legal argument advanced by the Attorney General's four-page summary. True, the Mueller investigation finding that the Russian government hacked our election to the benefit of Donald Trump does not find unassailable proof of a Russian conspiracy with the Trump campaign. On the issue of obstruction of justice, however, the report declines to say. Attorney General Barr, in his summary, has no trouble saying, however, the president didn't obstruct because no crime was committed.
Barr says, because there was no underlying crime of collusion, therefore there can't be obstruction. And we know that's actually legally not true, right? Martha Stewart is one of many people who get tagged for obstruction, even though the underlying crime isn't there. That happens every day. I think it's really important to understand that Mueller split the difference, right? Mueller said, I didn't find collusion, presumably. And then he said, on obstruction, I don't exonerate him and I don't have a finding, right? It was a net nothing. And for Barr to say, and thus, Rosenstein and I take it upon ourselves to make a conclusion of law, mm-hmm. and we will determine that there's no obstruction, that's not how this goes, right? Orrin Kerr, professor at Georgetown, tweeted, imagine if the Starr report had been provided only to President Clinton's attorney general, Janet Reno, who then read it privately and published a four-page letter based on her private reading stating her conclusion that President Clinton committed no crimes. And the last layer, Brooke, is this, and it's important. Barr auditions for this job with a 19-page memo, secret memo, to the White House in which he says, the president can't possibly commit obstruction because of this unitary executive theory that says that the president, right, is in charge of everybody in the executive branch. Therefore, if he fires Comey, there's no question there.
Because they're all one thing. It's like slapping your own hand.
Like, it's so insane in the sort of line of decision-making that a person who asked for this job because he said there's no such thing as obstruction turned around and concluded that there was no obstruction. If that is the case, please let us see the hundreds of pages of documents and allow the American people and Congress to make a determination about whether obstruction occurred, because apparently Mueller couldn't make that determination.
You know, for those of us who aren't lawyers— it just seems so bizarre since obstruction was in plain sight. I mean, the president told Lester Holt on network television that he fired Comey because of the Russia thing.
And in fact, when I decided to just do it, I said to myself, I said, you know, this Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story. It's an excuse by the Democrats for having lost an election.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really confounding about this, and I do think this is a thing that the media needs to think through better, I guess, which means, Brooke, you and I need to think it through, is this question of what did it mean that this was all unrolling in real time?
Which takes you to the Saturday Night Live skit.
You didn't fire him because of his Russian investigation.
No, I did.
Trump confessing to Lester Holt.
I thought, he's investigating Russia. I don't like that. I should fire him.
And Lester Holt going...
Wait, what? And you're just admitting that?
Uh-huh.
But that's obstruction of justice.
Sure, okay.
Wait, so did I get him?
He sort of puts his hand on his earphone and says...
No, I didn't. Nothing matters. Absolutely nothing matters anymore.
That's true on the corruption front. I mean, the Trump Foundation, the whole thing is completely illegitimate enterprise. The cashing in at the hotels or on Ivanka's trademarks in China. I mean, all of this happens in plain sight. And there's a deeply strange counterfactual where if all of this had happened in secret and we didn't know about it, and then it was all in the Mueller report instead of the front pages of the Washington Post day after day for 2 years, would we be shocked and horrified?
Are you as frustrated as I am with the media coverage? The fact that there have been so many words, so much ink, so much time committed to a four-page thing.
I think that nature abhors a media vacuum. You know this better than anyone. And if we have to just sort of spin dross into gold in order to sort of create a story in which someone won and someone lost, because that's what we do best, I think you're right. It's frustrating.
I just thought cable news became a complete parody of itself. If it says this, then it means that. Or in the case of Fox News, it means...
Happy No Collusion Day, Tucker.
Happy No Collusion Day.
I think the Fox News message to Republicans was that we won witch hunt, fake news, now let's go after Hillary's emails. I mean, it's clear that there's going to be a doubling down. And this is what's mysterious about Mueller, because Mueller knew that the special counsel's office, the Justice Department, the FBI were all under attack. And by equivocating, he gave fodder. The whole thing was fake news, and therefore we have to go after the media and go after the Justice Department. And that's the scary message.
But isn't this a sign that the legal system works for the right if Trump isn't found culpable for anything?
You know, you would think that's the sort of magic part of this, that when Rudy Giuliani was asked, does this mean that you were too hard on Robert Mueller and that, in fact, this process was fair and just? And his answer was, no, still no.
No, Mueller did his hand it back.
He went on to make up some number of millions of dollars that Mueller had been paid, which was not.
Upwards of $30 million. But he couldn't make the key decision. His hands were shaking.
No, I think actually the trick here is that you get to both say that this fair and just process completely exonerated the president and that the process was completely corrupt. And please don't ask me to square those two things. I can't.
So there's been an argument over the coverage, the gullibility versus the culpability of the press for leading Americans down a primrose path. Are there lessons the media would do well to learn from this episode?
I think the media is doing a very, very good job watchdogging this president. That's the story. The story isn't Mueller. It's that what Mueller was doing in the dark turns out to be exactly the thing we've all been doing in open daylight, which is exposing corruption, exposing self-dealing, and explaining what it means. So I guess I would say the media sin was myopic focus on this one version of it. But I think generally, the media has done really dogged and admirable work. I can't fault them for that.
Well, what about the rest of us? Assuming we don't get to see the full report, do we then watch and wait for other investigations? I mean, for those seeking national redemption, should we expect it from the law?
Well, that's been a question I've been asking myself for a long time. I think that there was a hope that a legal investigation and prosecution would save us. And more, I think that what Mueller was saying is there is a legal mechanism to remove this president, and it's not a special counsel indicting the president. It's impeachment. And, you know, Congress is in the midst of a lot of soul searching about whether it's an inopportune time or how to do that. But I think that's the legal answer. Mm-hmm. And so the better question is, what do we as citizens who are sitting around waiting for the next person on the white horse with the sword to save us, what are we doing to sort of be that person on the horse with the sword ourselves? Whether it's, you know, voting or making sure other people people vote or being informed or fighting for free speech and free press, whatever it is. I don't think that Mueller was going to give all that back to us. That's for us to take.
Does collective action really affect the decisions of Congress and the courts to any great degree?
I think public action hugely affects the behavior of certainly Congress. I think the courts are not meant to be responsive to public opinion, and that's its own good thing.
Although you did say back in an interview we did during the Muslim ban that it was your perception that all of that action in the streets was kind of shifting the norm, pulling the Overton window, perhaps.
I definitely think that the courts take notice of public opinion, and it would be delusional to say they don't notice. But I think that the institution that we are meant to be lobbying is Congress. That's how they set it up. And Congress is incredibly responsive time and time again. People picking up the phone and calling their congressman has made a huge difference in the early months of this administration. And it can still. This is not a we-them problem. And this is not a Fox News, MSNBC problem. I think that this is a problem of, do we want a direct representative democracy in which the president is not above the law in a Nixonian sense, or do we not? And I think that's still a bipartisan problem. It seems to me that a lot of the things we're talking about today, which is simple transparency, which is that the attorney general doesn't make conclusions of law. He hands the document over to those entities that do. This question of, are we safe from Russian interference into elections and Russian hacking? All of those are not us-them questions. And so I think maybe, you know, when you ask what the cardinal sin of the media is, it's not smoking out those things, which I think are pretty universal rule of law ideas, and highlighting and lifting those ideas up for us to talk about instead of facts that we still don't know about.
Dahlia, thank you very much.
Brooke, it's always a pleasure.
Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate, and she's also host of their podcast, Amicus. Coming up, when it comes to our president, the past really is prologue. If you only look. This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The end to the Mueller investigation has been wholly unsatisfying for those who see Trump's presidency as an aberrant detour on conservatism's march. I mean, we have democratic socialists and we have far-right conservatives, but this presidency, this in-your-face self-dealing, this breakdown in civility, it seems altogether new. Of course it's not. But political science professor Corey Robbins says that our failure to draw connections between Trump and what came before continually leads us to misread the present and is part of a larger pattern of forgetting in America's political culture.
I first began noticing it during the run-up to the November 2016 presidential campaign, most prominently at the Democratic National Convention, where Ronald Reagan was resurrected among Democrats as a kind of hero, somebody to counterpose against Donald Trump. Since then, that tendency to reinvent conservatives' past has grown only stronger.
In your article, you focus on various rehabilitations of history or reassessments or reimaginings. And the most obvious example, for you anyway, was George W. Bush.
Yeah, not just for me, actually. Even Saturday Night Live took notice of this.
So I just wanted to address my fellow Americans tonight and remind you guys that I was really bad. Like, historically not good.
Right. You wrote that when Bush left office in 2009, he was widely loathed. He had an approval rating of 33%, and today it's 61%, and a lot of that comes from Democrats and independents.
And not just Democrats and independents, also younger voters who really loathed Bush during the Iraq War and the Bush years, but now look back on him fondly. He seems to represent a kind of different conservatism from the one that we have today. One of the most shocking images to me was a photograph that was taken of Michelle Obama with George W. Bush. And in that, she's hugging him and their faces are nuzzling together. And she expresses what seems to be a genuine affection. And it's one thing to read statements and make statements about people, some of whom are no longer with us. It's one thing to welcome somebody into the fold from a long, long time ago, but that wasn't that long ago.
Here's George W. Bush talking about his friendship with Michelle.
That surprised everybody. That's what's so weird about society today, you know, that people on opposite sides of the political spectrum could actually like each other.
I mean, that's nice, isn't it?
It's not just a personal moment between two individuals. Michelle Obama is a leading voice of the Democratic Party. What that is really saying is bygones are bygones. The past is the past. And meanwhile, we live in a country that is still in Iraq. This is a mistake that still lives with us. The veterans who have had limbs blown off, the people of Iraq who have endured what they've had to endure, what does that say to them?
And you see this as part of a much broader pattern. You cite Philip Roth, who wrote during the Nixon years that there was a sense of living in a country with a government morally out of control and wholly in business for itself. And then 10 years later, he wrote about the era that Watergate made life interesting when I wasn't writing, but from 9 to 5 every day, I didn't think too much about Nixon or about Vietnam. And now when he compares Trump to Nixon, he says that Nixon wasn't anything like as humanly impoverished as Trump is.
You see two things that are going on there. One is an insistence that whatever you're currently confronting is something we've never seen before, on the one hand. And then on the other hand, the very person who 10 years ago you would have been reviling in exactly the same terms suddenly becomes anodyne, human, a man you'd want to hug. There's a relationship between those two things. One makes the other possible.
You were making the point that Trump isn't so different from what happened in the past. And people were really upset with you for normalizing Trump. And you found this perplexing until your wife explained it to you.
As my wife explained it to me, people instead heard me as saying, you know, this guy isn't so bad. We survived the Iraq War. We survived Ronald Reagan. We'll survive this. Just go on about your business. And I think people get a sense that when you try to argue for continuity, somehow or another, the message is one of mitigation and diminution, whereas mm-hmm. I think it actually accentuates the task that we have to now confront.
Right. You wrote, and I love this, that we think the contrast of a burnished past allows us to see the burning present. But all it does is keep the fire going and growing. Confronting the indecent Nixon, Roth imagines a better McCarthy. Confronting the indecent Trump, he imagines a better Nixon. At no point does he recognize that he's been fighting the same monster all along and losing. Roth, you write, doesn't see how the rehabilitation of the last monster allows the front line to move rightward, the new monster to get closer to the territory being defended.
American liberals and Democrats have been fighting the right for a very long time. We've had different iterations of that right wing: Barry Goldwater, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, Newt Gingrich, George W. Bush, and now Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And at every turn, there is an insistence that this is like something we've never seen before. And part of the reason for that insistence is a sense that this is how you rally the base. But even if we vanquish Newt Gingrich or George W. Bush, the terrain on which we're fighting is getting closer and closer to what the right ultimately wants.
Is it because liberals and Democrats are constantly making this an issue of an individual rather than a web of ideas?
Absolutely. The comparison that I try to invoke is someone like FDR or Abraham Lincoln. These were realignment presidents. Presidents who don't just run against a candidate. They don't even just run against a party. They run against a whole nexus or web of ideas and institutions, and they really want to take it out entirely and create a different kind of a country. When liberals make the issue Richard Nixon's individual perfidy or Ronald Reagan's distance from factual reality or George W. Bush's lack of command over the facts and what's going on, they are signaling to everybody, just get this guy out and maybe some of his people as well, and all will go back to normal. And I think these are missed opportunities. You could imagine saying that Donald Trump and his treatment of women and his views on Muslims and people of color and his views on taxes, these are not singular aberrations. These are, in fact, connected to a whole set of ideas that have really governed us now going back at least to the 1970s and 1980s, and that he reveals to us everything that has been wrong in this country for an extraordinarily long time, and that in going after him, we are going to go after all of that. And instead, he gets cordoned off as this mess of a human being, but we forget to see how that mess is emblematic of just a much, much larger mess that is this country.
I assume that people run against character because it helps them win elections.
I think it's dawning on a lot of people that it's not enough just to win an election. You have to transform the country in a more fundamental way.
Structural changes.
Absolutely.
Not just a different coat of paint.
Yeah, exactly. One can see the strategic benefits, again, in the short term, but the task of liberalism and the left becomes ever, ever narrower. If America's already great, why do you need to increase taxes, redistribute wealth, to confront problems of schooling? What do you say about the fact that the United States is now more segregated than it was under Ronald Reagan? All of the factual tasks that are at hand that liberals traditionally would have wanted to take up suddenly are swept off the table.
Corey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Corey Robin is a professor of political science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center. His book is called The Reactionary Mind: Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Donald Trump. Coming up, the president's border wall could be seen as definitively marking the end of American expansionism. This is On the Media. This is Brooke. When you've finished listening to OTM this week, why don't you head over to the New Yorker Radio Hour? David Remnick sat down with Jerry Seinfeld, who just directed his first movie about Pop-Tarts.
Did you really like Pop-Tarts all that much growing up?
Oh, yeah.
How about now?
Still, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I love them.
That's a good breakfast for you?
I eat it after a bad show on a Wednesday night.
Listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
So do what Brooke says. Come join us for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. James Monroe, writing about the U.S. in the 1820s, declared, "There is no object which as a people we can desire, which we do not possess, or which is not within our reach." That sentiment has driven centuries of history and that peculiar notion we call American exceptionalism. That seemingly limitless reach, that unappeasable desire, is said to have its roots in America's relationship with the frontier. Those of us alive today feel it mostly metaphorically. John F. Kennedy in 1960.
"And we stand today on the edge of a new frontier. The frontier of the 1960s. The frontier of unknown opportunities and perils. The frontier of unfilled hopes and unfilled threats."
Ronald Reagan in 1982.
As we hold to this new path, you and your forebears, as Malcolm said, tamed a wild frontier. And believe it or not, you did it without an area redevelopment program or urban renewal.
George W. Bush promising to, quote, extend the frontiers of freedom in the war on terror.
The story of America is the story of expanding liberty, an ever-widening circle, constantly growing to reach further and include more.
Endless possibility, but also endless consumption, endless military might. Presidents have promised boundless opportunity by pushing our boundaries ever outward, whatever the cost. But in his new book, The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America, historian Greg Grandin says that the movement outward has come to a screeching halt.
We're going to build the wall. We have no choice. We have no choice. Build that wall. Build that wall. Build that wall.
But first, Grandin takes us back to the underpinnings of the frontier ideology.
Ceaseless expansion. That there is no problem caused by expansion that can't be solved by more expansion.
In the next few weeks, we'll be unpacking the national narrative of expansion and exceptionalism. Next week, we'll expand our inquiry overseas, but this week, we've enlisted Greg Grandin as our transcontinental guide.
Thomas Jefferson's first political tract a couple of years before drafting the Declaration of Independence held out that the right to pick up and move, to escape tyranny, wasn't just a natural right, it was the condition of all other natural rights. And Jefferson laid out a moral history in which Saxon free men in what is now Germany, when feudalism began to take hold, picked up and moved over to the British Isles. And then when the layers of social life began to weigh heavy on Saxons and on the British Islands, then they just moved over to the Americas. His argument is that movement allows all other rights to take place.
And the founders acknowledged always that there would be tension between the haves and the have-nots. And James Madison's solution would be to extend the sphere, meaning territory.
The founders were fairly clear that a concentration of wealth would cause a problem to Republican virtue. One solution that was put forward by Jefferson was to redistribute property every generation so it didn't build up.
Take it from people?
He gave up that idea pretty quickly. And the solution that presented itself was fairly obvious, to extend the sphere, as Madison put it.
He believed that citizens spread over a wide territory would be less likely to join, quote, common interest or passion, or to discover their own strength and to act in unison with each other. This is pretty frank stuff.
Yeah, expansion was held out as the breaker of every paradox, the allayer of every fear.
So there was a metaphor for what expansion did, for its use as a remedy. It was called the safety valve to relieve the pressure. The pressure of what?
Well, one was a class pressure, the increasing number of wage laborers, immigrants that were coming into the country. How do you prevent a labor party from forming, for instance, that might challenge the sacrosanct right of private property? And the second problem the safety valve was thought to solve was the question of slavery.
You quote the editor of the Western Monthly Review, Timothy Flint. He proposed America buy Mexican territory because it would serve as the proper escape valve from the danger of too great an accumulation of blacks in the slave states, thinning the population by diffusing it over great surfaces. And when it comes to class, you have the Massachusetts Congressman Caleb Cushing in 1839, who called the West the great safety valve of our population.
One of the dangers that somebody like Cushing identified was that as the vote was extended to unpropertied white men, to working class, illiterate white men, the fear was that they would use that vote to vote in socialism, to vote in a labor party. So what to do? Their answer was to use the expansion west, the distribution of public land in the west, as a way of diffusing and dispersing concentrated social demands.
It seems that Cushing was also a bit of a libertarian because he hoped that the westward movement would also keep the government occupied.
Well, exactly, because that's the second problem, right? That the problem of concentrated wealth and the problem of social movements contesting that concentrated wealth is that you wind up having the growth of government trying to solve the problem, either becoming overly repressive in clamping down on the demands or overly generous in distributing property. And either of those solutions were anathema to somebody like Cushing. So what's the solution? You go west.
To explain how that frontier mentality set the U.S. on its ruggedly individualist trajectory, Grandin suggests we pause at 1848. Across Europe, it was a year of revolution. Workers were rising up in Paris, in Berlin, in Milan, where the La Scala Opera House was closed during a riot, delaying the opening of this work, Mercadante's opera, The Saracen Slave. The poor were waging war on the rich. Waging war upward.
It was like a wildfire, and basically it thrust the class question, the question of economics, into the political sphere. When you have the rise of industrial factories, when you have the spread of economic immiseration, from that moment, there emerges labor parties, an ethic of social democracy, the beginning of social rights, not just political rights, not just the right to property or the right to assemble or the right to have free speech, but the right to health care, the right to education, rights that take a more activist government to form. In some ways, that's the inflection point, and that's what the United States does not develop. Its liberal tradition does not socialize. It does not move from embracing political rights and individual rights to expanding the palette to include the right to education, the right to health care. And 1848 is an interesting turning point. They don't have a revolution. What they have is a racist war against Mexico.
The end of the 19th century was a period of political theories. The dominant figure responsible for turning the frontier from a mappable place into an abstract idea is Frederick Jackson Turner at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair.
Up until that point, historians tended to argue what they called the germ theory of history. By that, they didn't actually mean bacteria, but they meant that everything that was good about American Anglo-Saxon culture came wholesale from Europe.
Germ meaning germinate.
The seed. That basically the Puritans created nothing. Their institutions were already perfected from Europe. Turner, born in Wisconsin, Midwestern, he turns that on its head. He says that what was good and unique and dynamic about America was born in America. It was born on the frontier. And he identified a number of particular traits that he felt were exceptional to the United States. One was individualism, crude intelligence that was practical, that was innovative, that was resilient. This becomes, in some ways, the foundation of an organic American-born Americanism.
And as you wrote, he glosses over the small matter of the series of Indian wars and the slavery question. The frontiersman is virtuous. There's no reference to the high price paid by some for the myth of boundless American freedom.
Absolutely. The frontier theory was implicitly and at times explicitly racist. But it's important to note that it didn't elevate racism as a motor of history.
The way the germ theory
The way did. That somebody like Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt was also an historian. For him, war and the domination of Native Americans was the engine of history. It was from this violent, primal confrontation with base nature in the form either of Native Americans or of the natural world that creates civilization. There's none of that in Turner. Turner barely mentions war. Nothing as brutal that is on every page of Theodore Roosevelt.
It isn't slaughter
it
that
isn't slaughter.
Elevates one.
And this is important because America's about to launch itself into the Pacific, into the world. And if it has claims to universalism, that kind of out-and-out racism of the Saxon germ theory or of Theodore Roosevelt's war against nature is not a particularly useful way to think of how to organize the world. So Turner becomes an important way in which racism becomes sidelined. And the implication of his theory is that as the U.S. moves across the frontier, racism is left behind as a residue.
The frontier thesis, according to Turner, was a way to explain the formation of our national psyche through a particular sequence of events. First, settlers arrived in the wilderness. Then enterprising families follow after to work the land. Think Little House on the Prairie.
We crossed into Kansas 4 days ago. What are you looking for?
We had no future where we were. It was a hand-to-mouth existence at best. I want more than that for you and the children. 160 acres free and clear from the government. To plant and harvest my own crops, to be owing to no man. I want that.
Eventually, those families assemble into communities, and then the communities coalesce to form civil society. And then, as Turner put it, as by magic, markets emerge.
Yeah, I need a plow and seed, not for 100 acres.
Well, you've come to the right man. I sell only the best.
Finally, after everything is created and set in motion, the state arrives.
And the state's only legitimate function is to protect virtue, not to create virtue in the form of social rights.
But it was a lie. And he knew it.
It was a lie, and he knew it. In one of the articles that he was reading where he got a lot of his ideas, he has a little notation that says, government came before. Because the fact is that you don't have any of these things without government. You don't remove Native Americans off the land. Move them west. You don't create the infrastructure needed to create markets without a strong state. The West had always been the terrain of large-scale corporations or federal infrastructure projects that preceded the ideal of virtuous civil society mixed with nature.
The premise that the state doesn't show up till the end gave ballast to the idea that it had no responsibility to create social or economic rights. These things offered by the state would be perverse or unvirtuous?
This is a foundational premise of the ideal of a minimal state, of the ideal of individual rights being the only legitimate rights.
They want to replace individual rights with total government domination.
We know jobs are not created by government. Jobs are created by free markets.
Thomas Jefferson said, government that governs least governs best.
The denial of the state and government action and federal action in creating this world allows this fiction to take root and to flower.
I still don't get it. They're saying that it is literally unvirtuous to offer health care or education or welfare. Why?
Well, it would entail an intrusion in the realm of economics.
Meaning you'd have to tax people to pay for it.
You'd have to tax people to pay for it. You have to regulate the economy. Mm-hmm. I mean, what we call libertarianism in this country has deep roots.
By the 1890s, the frontier had come to an end. The census officially declared there was no more open land in the West. Yet, the U.S. kept expanding to Puerto Rico, to Hawaii, to the Philippines. But more on that next week. Let's just observe that in discussing expansion post-1898, President Woodrow Wilson said, quote, "We made new frontiers for ourselves beyond the seas."
Turner was a friend of Wilson and went along with pretty much everything Wilson did.
He was such a racist. He was just as racist as Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes, yes. The frontier thesis moves from an historical theory to an ideology. It moves from an explanation of how and why something has happened to an argument for why something should happen. The frontier is understood not just as a line to stop at, but a line to cross over. There's not one president that doesn't use the frontier thesis to justify American power in the world.
But in some precincts, Turner's thesis was turned against itself. In 1912, Walter Weil, the future founding editor of the New Republic, wrote a piece describing the individualism championed by Turner as a curse. The westward march of the pioneer, gave to Americans a psychological twist, which was to hinder the development of a socialized democracy. The open continent intoxicated the American. It gave him an enlarged view of self. It dwarfed the common spirit. It made the American mind a little sovereignty of its own, acknowledging no allegiances and but few obligations. It created an individualism, self-confident, short-sighted, lawless, doomed in the end to defeat itself, as the boundless opportunism which gave it birth became at last circumscribed.
Right? It's right there in that Walter Weil line that it inhibited a socialized democracy. The frontier is still being used to explain America, but now they're explaining all the things that are bad about America, all the things that are preventing America from developing a government that has the capacity to respond to mounting social problems. Weil used the word slum almost as much as Turner used the word frontier, right? There was a sense that political inequality, all the problems that come with industrialization, all the problems that come with mass migration, all of the problems that come with the rise of cities and concentrated populations, that the federal government was completely incapable of addressing those problems.
So, after the Great Depression was met with a bootless response from Herbert Hoover, Franklin Roosevelt endorsed the frontier theory as an explanation of the nation's past, and then, in his 1932 presidential campaign, declared it defunct.
So, in his famous Commonwealth Club speech in San Francisco during the presidential campaign, he spent some time laying out the Turner thesis and trying to explain the development of American capitalism and all of the good things that came from that. And then with just one sentence, he would just say, "But those days are gone."
In 1938, on the third anniversary of the signing of the Social Security Act, he brought it up again.
"And because it has become increasingly difficult for individuals to build their own security single-handed, government must now step in and help them lay the foundation stones. Just as government in the past has helped lay the foundation of business and industry."
Leveraging the power of the state to cure what ails its people? Now that was virgin territory.
"There is still today a frontier that remains unconquered, an America unreclaimed. This is the great and nationwide frontier of insecurity, of human want and human fear. This is the frontier, the America, that we have set ourselves to reclaim."
Roosevelt's brain trust wove Turner's thesis into all facets of the New Deal, including efforts to cope with the Dust Bowl brought on by unsustainable frontier farming.
A kind of strip mining of the soil that happened as a result of expansion, of just like moving on and moving on and moving on. And what these New Dealers did was they basically just affixed the word social to all these Turnerian categories. So instead of having democracy, now you had social democracy. Instead of having education, you had social education. Instead of having civilization, you had a social civilization.
"Social justice through social action."
And he was also good at using the Turner thesis to explain the social relations of existence. He has one phrase, "this man-made world of ours." Again, these turns of phrases that capture a whole worldview, a new political ethic, a new political culture that was laying the groundwork for the closest the United States came to some kind of social democracy.
Isn't it weird how the argument over the frontier theory just keeps recurring and recurring? Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
Here he is in his The Summer of Our Discontent speech in 1964.
"We are a nation that worships the frontier tradition, and our heroes are those who champion justice through violent retaliation against injustice. It is not simple to adopt the credo that moral force has as much strength and virtue as a capacity to return a physical blow. That to refrain from hitting back requires more will and bravery than the automatic reflexes of defense."
Yeah, and it speaks to the deeper level in which King presented his nonviolence, not just as a tactic, but really as a counter value to the whole of American history. King saw something deeply pathological in the myth of the West, in what he called rugged individualism for the many and the poor, but socialism for the rich in the form of subsidies and write-offs. And if somebody like Turner and other moral philosophers believed that individualism and the legitimacy of self-government had to do with your ability to regulate yourself, use your virtues to control your emotions, King transferred that more into the social realm, and he talked about African Americans who move through the social wilderness of racism and were able to not give in to anger and not give in to justifiable rage. And that was a higher claim to self-governance.
The Vietnam War, what Grandin calls the first frontier war we lost, was rife with frontier imagery. Soldiers gave names like Crazy Horse and Sam Houston to their air and ground operations and reportedly cut off the ears of dead Vietnamese. The historian Richard Drinnan noted that it was, quote, as if cowboys and Indians were the only game the American invaders knew. In 1970, the Mexican author Octavio Paz described the U.S. as a, quote, giant which is walking faster and faster along a thinner and thinner line. With the Vietnam War, Grandin says, the U.S. hit its limit. It was around this time that the idea of border walls started to loom larger in the public's imagination, and conflict and vigilantism on the border became even more acute. In 1977, the Ku Klux Klan, led by David Duke, set up a border watch that was much covered by the press and supported by patrol agents. The association with that lost frontier war in Indochina went beyond the symbolic.
These sheet metal landing pads that were used to land helicopters and cargo planes in Vietnam, they were brought over and used as some of the first physical structures along the border.
And I was struck when you wrote that some of the fencing was repurposed from the Crystal City Japanese-American internment camp.
Right. So you see the wall taking shape from all of these different sediments and moments of U.S. racial history, the internments of Japanese in 1948, some of the first fencing when that internment camp in Crystal City was disassembled, the chain length and the posts were then used on the southern border.
If the country's lived past the end of its myth, the frontier myth, what replaces it?
The border wall. The idea that the world's resources are not limitless, not everybody could sit at the table, that the United States needs to batten down and needs to turn inward.
It's going to be only America first. America first.
The unique ability to constantly deflect outward, to flee forward, to divert social contradictions and class conflict and rate outward, to roll over the trauma from the last war into the next war, to use the promise of growth to organize domestic politics, to say whatever problems we have now will be solved in the future through more expansion. Now that that is no longer an option, the promise of unlimited growth has come crashing down in terms of the exhaustion of the economic model, the exhaustion of the military model, and climate change.
Tell me again why you wrote this book.
I was trying to figure out a way to get beyond what had seemed to be a simplistic opposition in talking about Trump. Trump was either presented as completely unprecedented, an interruption in the United States' long history of proceduralism and pluralism and multilateralism and openness, or if one was more critical of the United States, Trump was presented as the culmination of a brutality that was there from the beginning and settled a colonial expansion. You know, I think that opposition fails to account for the contingencies of more immediate history, what happened with Iraq, what happened with changes in the political economy, what happens with climate change, and the way that that has scrambled politics and the way politics could be organized. I was trying to present a way to think about Trump historically that didn't fall into one or the other. He's wholly new, or he's just the fulfillment of settler colonialism.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke, for having me.
Greg Grandin is a professor of history at New York University and author of The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Micah Lowinger, Leah Feder, John Hanrahan, and Asta Chaturvedi. We had more help from Zandra Ellen, and our show is edited by me and Katya. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.